A decade-long study of baby food released by Healthy Babies, Bright Futures claims that 95% of commercial baby foods contain toxic heavy metals that can result in autism spectrum and attention deficit disorders. And so we ask, should grocers be allowed to sell baby foods that contain toxic heavy metals?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,403rd edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends up there in Aberdeen who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Or whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, consider Michael Olson's second law of the food chain. The farther we go from the source of our food, the less control we have over what's in our food. When it comes to feeding our babies, we the people have gone a long ways from the source of our food. Where we once fed our babies fresh foods right off the farm, we now feed our babies foods from commercial packages that come from thousands of miles away. As a consequence of all that distance, we have lost a lot of control over what we feed our babies. Case in point, a 2021 House Subcommittee on Economic and Consumer Policy report revealed that a number of leading baby food manufacturers knowingly sold products that contain dangerous levels of toxic heavy metals, including arsenic, lead, cadmium, and mercury. Fearful of the impact the toxic heavy metals might be having on the brains of their babies, parents throughout the United States rose up and took the manufacturers to court. Consequent to the release of the subcommittee's study and the parents' lawsuits, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration developed an action plan it called Closer to Zero, to reduce the amount of toxic heavy metals in baby foods. Though the feds have been making progress, some say not enough progress and not fast enough. And so today we pause to ask the question, should grocers be allowed to sell baby foods that contain toxic heavy metals? Well, who better to ask than attorney Pedram Asfandiari, I knew I was going to blow it, Asfandiari. Did I get it right that time?
Almost.
Asfandiari, right?
Asfandiari, thank you.
Asfandiari, all right. We'll work it through and I'll have it perfect by the end of the show, I'm sure. And he is with Wissner Baum, LLP. Did I get Wissner right?
You did.
Okay, good. And you're a big law firm that specializes in watching over consumers and protecting them, as it were. And you're a law firm, Pedram, is at representing 8,000 families across the country against some of the top names in the manufacturing of baby foods. I'm certain you must have considered our open question for today's show, so I'll put it on the table for you just to get the show going. Should grocers be allowed to sell baby foods that contain toxic heavy metals?
Ideally, no, but the answer is actually a little bit more complicated than that. So the heavy metals we're talking about, lead, arsenic, mercury in some cases, are pretty much present in almost every aspect of our environment, such as the food we eat, the air we breathe, the water we drink, the soil where the food is grown. The question isn't how do we ensure zero heavy metals in food? The question is how can manufacturers who have the responsibility of ensuring the safety of their products ensure that they contain the lowest scientifically possible quantity of heavy metals when we're feeding this stuff to the most vulnerable segment of our population, being babies? And go ahead.
You know, I just think of all of the incidents of autism that we've been witnessing and the increase in the rate of autism and so on that we've been experiencing over the past couple decades. And one wonders, are these two issues related?
I think they are to some extent. I think the rising rates of autism have a lot to do with more refined clinical criteria. It's easier to screen and identify cases of autism. We have more advanced screening tools for that and better access to care. Not for all communities. Many communities still do suffer from a lack of access to care in the medical system. However, the increasing trends in autism can be explained by that, as well as scientists more and more propose changes in our environment, exposure to greater levels of toxins in the environment, particularly through food. And it's interesting because the number one source of lead exposure for children in the United States is through food. For children aged 1 to 6 years old, the number one source of lead exposure is through food. So that's a pretty significant source of exposure, given that this is what we need to eat in order to survive day to day. And kids eat quite a lot of it, given that they're going through the most significant developmental period of their life, that early period where the body is going through rapid changes and needs quite a bit of food to sustain itself. Lead exposure and arsenic exposure through food can be a pretty significant concern. And scientists are recognizing that exposure to these toxins can explain the onset of symptoms for many kids.
So the answer to the question is not as simple as it might seem. Of course, grocers should not be selling toxic heavy metals to kids in their baby food. They should avoid that, but it's ubiquitous.
It is. I think part of the problem is also one of informed consent. So, what manufacturers need to do, and this really is the responsibility of manufacturers making these products, is number one, ensure that they're manufacturing safe products that contain the lowest levels of heavy metals possible. And they can do that through various ways. For example, a significant source of arsenic exposure comes from rice, particularly
Rice.
brown rice. Kids don't need brown rice. There's plenty of other alternatives to brown rice available. Farro, buckwheat. I mean, there is a host of other ingredients that can replace brown rice and meet the nutritional needs of babies and ingredients that are not as contaminated with arsenic. So there is manufacturing and sourcing decisions that producers of baby food can make in order to significantly reduce the presence of metals in the food. Also, informing consumers about what is in the food. It's interesting. When you go out to Home Depot and you buy a bag of soil, garden variety, regular type soil to plant things in, there's a little QR code on that bag saying, for information about the presence of heavy metals in this product, scan this code. We have that for soil, yet we haven't had that until this year for baby food. So a gardener wanting to ensure that whatever they're growing in the garden doesn't take up too much heavy metals through the soil they're using can exercise informed consent by scanning the QR code on the soil, on the bag of soil, and seeing what the presence of lead and other metals is in that bag. We did not have such a labeling requirement for baby food until this year, and we only have it in, I think, at this point, one or two states. California just enacted a law that requires that manufacturers selling baby food put a little QR code on
What's
their
in
food products that parents can scan to see what the presence of heavy metals in it. They never had to do that before, and they still don't have to do that in the majority of states, and there's no federal obligation that they do that. So I think it's a two-hit punch. We have to ensure, manufacturers have to ensure lower levels of metals, as well as informing consumers on what is in the products that babies are eating.
Well, I imagine that, were a young mother to scan a label and see that the baby food contains lead and arsenic and cadmium and who knows what, she would probably freak out and think,
Well,
I can't buy this. I don't want to feed this to my baby. So what can I feed my baby? And that we get back to the question, should grocers be allowed to sell the baby food that contain these things? And that the heavy metals are pretty much ubiquitous in the environment and in the baby food and everywhere. We just have to come to grips with the fact that we have to figure out how to feed the babies the least possible amount.
That's right. And really, this is not so much about what the consumer can do, because the responsibility is not upon the consumer to find safe food. It's upon the people who manufacture our food to ensure that we have a safe food supply. So when you're selling a baby food product, Given that we live in a post-industrial world where we're exposed to toxins everywhere, it is our duty as a society to mitigate in the areas where we can the toxic exposures that we get, right? What we know is possible to make change and reduce children's exposure to metals, why not do it? And here, after the lawsuits have been filed and Congress has become involved and legislatures have become involved, we've seen, for the better, a drastic drop in the presence of heavy metals in baby food. We've actually seen the levels go down sometimes tenfold between, 10 years ago and today because manufacturers are finally taking steps to address this issue.
And it's working.
It's
And so
working.
we're getting there, but not fast enough and not far enough, correct?
That's right. And I feel like a lot of the products that are being sold right now, manufacturers who make baby food, where they test every single batch of finished product for heavy metals and they really take steps to ensure the lowest levels of heavy metals, those brands tend to be pretty expensive. A lot of people, especially in today's economic world, simply cannot afford to pay the premium prices on those kinds of brands. So I feel like it's an issue of accessibility, which is shutting out large segments of society.
Yeah.
And of course, the privileged few who can spend the buck get to enjoy the privilege. But for most of society, this is just not a luxury they can afford. So we have to look at how to achieve greater accessibility.
You know, when you think about it, it's probably always been like that.
Absolutely.
You know, those who have a lot of money can afford to buy the best foods, whatever that case might be, and those with very little money have limited choices,
Course.
and that's probably been true throughout history when it gets right down to it. But especially important today when we have the means of reducing the amount of toxic heavy metals. And that really is what your lawsuit is all about, is it not?
That's right. We represent families, specifically children, who consumed pretty significant quantities of some of these baby foods, some of the worst types of the baby foods out there on the market during a time when the metal levels were pretty high. And as a result of that exposure, these kids suffered brain injury, unfortunately. And sometimes that brain injury can manifest in symptoms that doctors diagnose as autism and ADHD. So we represent these kids who have these conditions against the manufacturers that made this food in order to hopefully gain some kind of compensation for these kids and their family and ensure they have a better chance at life going forward.
And in doing so, you're cleaning up the food chain.
Absolutely. And if we've seen the results of that right now based on the metal testing of the manufacturers, the defendant manufacturers in these cases that are now publicly available, the metal testing in 2025 is drastically less. Contains significantly smaller amounts of heavy metals compared to their testing on the same products going back to 2016, 2017.
So closer to zero, but not quite there yet. But
That's
that's
right.
what we're fighting for. And we're fighting with attorney Pedro Esfandiari of Wissnerbaum and law firm. And they are taking the food manufacturers to court on behalf of 8,000 families around the United States. So we're going to take a quick break, but when we can come back, we're going to take a look inside the food and figure out how on earth all of that toxic heavy metal got into the food. So do stay tuned, right back.
Let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
And attorney Pedram Asfandiari of Wissner-Baum and California law firm. And we're fighting for the 8,000 families across the United States who decided that they just won't want to feed their babies toxic heavy metals in baby foods. A lot of interesting statistics that kind of leave you terrified when it gets right down to it. Padrón, do 95% of baby food products really contain toxic heavy metals? 95%?
I think there's a couple of things to bear in mind. When the legislators and the House committee report talk about the presence of heavy metals in baby food, you have to remember that the way we find out how much heavy metals contained in a baby food is we obviously test for it. And the testing instruments are sort of calibrated to detect the presence of these metals down to a certain level, right? So we don't have a testing instrument capable of telling you that this product contains zero amounts of lead. The best we have right now is testing instruments that can test to as low as 2 parts per billion, which is pretty low level of lead. 2 parts per billion is not very significant. So that is the most sophisticated advanced testing equipment we have. It can only tell you that this product contains less or more than 2 parts per billion. If it's less than 2 parts per billion of lead, it doesn't specify what that is. It just says less than 2 parts per billion. And if it's obviously more than 2 parts per billion, it'll tell you the number, either it's 3, 4, 5, right, 10, 20, whatever. So that's the state of the science. So when we say 95% of baby foods contain heavy metals, scientifically, it's actually 100% of baby food contain heavy metals. It's just a question of the degree and what testing instrument was used to test the product for the heavy metal. What we can say is that as of the date of the House committee report in 2021, the levels of heavy metals in many of the baby foods that were tested were far above 2 parts per billion. We were looking at 20, 30, sometimes 600 parts per billion of lead in one baby food. What the good news is that that has significantly changed. So for the same products that tested in the hundreds of parts per billion of lead are now testing at below 2 parts per billion of lead, which is a clear indication of progress and another sign that litigation and public outcry and government outreach and effort work in help addressing this kind of issue. So we have to be careful about what we mean when we talk about the statistics, and it's very important to not get lost in the numbers, but really understand the context.
Has there been a direct link identified between these toxic heavy metals and the impact on the baby's brain as they grow up?
Well, it's been known since antiquity, since the times of Aristotle and Plato and the Romans, that lead causes brain injury. I mean, there is no dispute about that. Lead and arsenic, all they do is harm the body, right? They have no biological function. We don't need lead or arsenic in our body. They're non-nutritious. All they do when they enter a human body is cause harm. Arsenic was used for decades as rat poison to kill rats. And lead, as we know, we're all familiar with the Flint, Michigan water crisis, is a very significant and harmful toxin. So what the science shows is not only is arsenic harmful in that it can cause things like cancer and damage to the liver and kidneys and stomach, it can also interfere with the child's brain. And it doesn't take very much arsenic or lead to do that because kids are so vulnerable. Their defense mechanisms haven't yet really taken root. And the lead and arsenic both are able to penetrate the protective layer in all of our brains known as the blood-brain barrier. And for kids, that blood-brain barrier is obviously very much underdeveloped, and lead and arsenic can cross that blood-brain barrier, and it doesn't take very many molecules of lead and arsenic to then start to do very significant damage to a kid's brains. And what the science shows is when a child's brain is damaged, many things can happen. For some kids, it means they have a lower IQ. In fact, the strongest data on lead is with respect to its harms on IQ. In fact, there are studies from the 70s and 80s actually quantifying the amounts of IQ loss within populations of children in urban American cities over the course of decades. We actually quantified this and the economic loss that comes with that. Another thing that could happen when a child is harmed by lead is it results in attention deficit behavior. And in fact, there are studies showing how lead has had a direct impact on increasing rates of criminality in urban American centers throughout the 60s and 70s when lead was still used in gasoline before it was banned from gasoline and other sources like paint. Another thing that can happen is it can cause cognitive damage and result in a child developing slower cognitively. And yet another thing that can happen is a child can show symptoms that doctors diagnose as autism. So what we're really talking about, lead exposure and the harms of lead exposure, we're talking about brain injury, and that brain injury can show itself in a number of different ways depending on the child.
Wow. So when it gets right down to it, we seem to be kind of stuck with it. But how does it get into the food during manufacturing? What is the means by which it gets into the can or the bottle?
That's a great question. So it's less to do with the manufacturing process and more to do with the sourcing. So, because heavy metals are contained in food crops and various ingredients used to manufacture food, when you source those ingredients, like the vegetables and the rice, they're going to contain the heavy metals, and then you put them all together to make the baby food, and the baby food contains heavy metals. So, it's really a sourcing issue. What we've seen is manufacturers being kind of sloppy and reckless and careless on where they source the ingredients. A lot of manufacturers have sourced their root vegetables. Root vegetables are notoriously famous for taking up high quantities of lead through the soil, carrots, sweet potatoes, so on and so forth. They've sourced these from heavily polluted areas. We know that, for example, rice, which is notoriously famous for taking up arsenic, rice grown in the southeastern United States has significantly more arsenic in it than rice grown in California. Rice grown in Spain has significantly less arsenic in it than rice grown in Bangladesh or India and Southeast Asia in general. So it's really a sourcing issue. Manufacturers have been pretty careless and reckless on how and where they're sourcing ingredients from. Also, the ingredient itself matters. As I said before, kids don't need rice, and yet rice is a significant source of arsenic. It can be easily replaced by a lower heavy metal alternative. Same with some of the the root vegetables. Some of these root vegetables and leafy greens that have high quantities of heavy metals can be replaced with alternatives that contain way less heavy metals. So it really is a sourcing decision and a manufacturing decision insofar as the choices manufacturers make on what ingredients to use to begin with in making their baby food.
I see where a number of the companies that have been found guilty of, selling baby foods with toxic heavy metals include a lot of organic companies. For example, Earth's Best Organic, Nurture Happy Family Organics, Plum Organics, and so on. So organic really isn't an issue because it seems to be where a lot of organic produce or organic foods are contain the toxic heavy metals as well.
That's right. Unfortunately, and this is something that consumers sometimes struggle to understand, is, well, I bought a product that says organic. How comes it's got toxins in it? Well, unfortunately, organic doesn't mean that a food is free from heavy metals. All organic means is a very specific definition relating to the use of pesticides and synthetic fertilizers and so on, which is good. Obviously, it's good to buy products that are regulated by the organic label that tend to contain less residue from pesticides and fertilizers. However, it doesn't mean that they're not going to contain heavy metals. The heavy metal issue is really separate and apart from the organic issue. And it's kind of been brushed under the carpet, and not much attention has been paid to heavy metals in food in general. Most of our focus has been over the last 2 or 3 decades on pesticides, fertilizers, mycotoxins, microplastics nowadays. Heavy metals have kind of been neglected, and it's unfortunate because they do represent a significant source of toxic exposure that we know children are particularly vulnerable to. But yes, no, buying, you cannot buy yourself out of heavy metals by just buying organic.
Okay, the only way you can really come close to that, close to zero, as it were, is in the sourcing
That's
of
right.
what you buy and what you buy buys as well. Because if you have patronizing a company that claims to be organic and they're sloppy in where they're sourcing their raw ingredients, you're going to come up with bad stuff,
That's right.
whether it's organic or not. That's a
That's exactly
significant.
right.
So the House subcommittee came out with its report in 2021, 5 years ago. How close is the government able to get to zero in its closer to zero campaign?
As close as the government wants to get is honestly the best answer. So the FDA implemented this closer to zero program in 2021 after these reports came out from Congress detailing the severe extent of contamination. The problem is that the F in the FDA, which stands for food, because it's the Food and Drug Administration, the F is all tends to be silent. And that's always been the case throughout history. It is acutely underfunded compared to the drug department. The FDA has historically had very little resources to take enforcement actions related to food and to implement realistic and meaningful safeguards when it comes to food protection, particularly in the area of heavy metals. So really, there is an issue of source of funding and resources, which have only gotten worse with this administration, unfortunately. And really a lack of initiative and will by the FDA to really run this issue to the ground. Now, I will also say that the FDA has also historically been very concerned with ensuring that manufacturers can make a buck without having to spend too much money to make a buck, and ensuring that manufacturers are able to sell products and achieve what they call feasibility of making products and enter the marketplace and then sell a product. And that has come at the expense of ensuring sometimes safety when it comes to things like the heavy metals. And we've seen a lack of will and a lack of initiative from the FDA historically that has gotten slightly better, but really we need real regulations that have teeth that will then force manufacturers to take drastic action in addressing this issue.
Traditionally, government and industry have grown pretty close together by virtue of the revolving door. Industry people take jobs in government, and then government people take jobs in industry, and so you develop this rather cozy relationship. And so it's hard then to see where the incentive is to really come down on a problem like this and fight it from the government, because the government is going to be protecting industry's ability to survive and vice versa. In a lot of regulatory schemes, the government charges, I guess, customers to regulate things. I think of hunting and fishing. The government charges people who want to go hunting and fishing a license fee, and that license fee pays for the government to regulate hunting and fishing and the animals thereof. So how is the food part of the Food and Drug Administration compensated for its work?
That honestly, I couldn't give you much of an insight to. I don't have a great deal of knowledge when it comes to how the actual department works and is funded and so on. What I have more experience with is actually what we talked about a little moment ago, the revolving door.
Right.
And what I've seen time and again from litigating cases like this, my firm historically has done a lot of litigation against pharmaceutical companies for selling unsafe products. It's really the same story of the revolving door of you have government officials in pretty significant positions of power at places like the FDA, then leave their government position to go and work for private industry, and then they will do that for a while and then go back to government and maintain those relationships and contacts, leading to this kind of cozy relationship between government and industry that then leads to all sorts of problems when it comes to enforcement and regulation, because there's then a lack of incentive when the fox is guarding the hen house to ensure the safety of products in both the drug world and the food element. I will say, in 2025, for the first time in history, the FDA finally issued its guidance on the allowable limits of lead in baby food. They had never done this before. That guidance is now finalized, and it mandates that manufacturers ensure that lead levels are kept below certain amounts in various categories of baby food. In my honest opinion, the levels are still too high. They don't really go low enough, but it is a step in the right direction. And in that document, the government recognizes that manufacturers can take a whole host of action to ensure lower levels of heavy metals like lead in baby food. So we're heading in the right direction. It's just not heading there quickly enough.
Well, one way to speed things up is to put a put some energy in the fight. And it seems like that's exactly what you are doing, Pedram Asfandiary, with respect to your efforts to sue on behalf of 8,000 parents here in the United States to make certain that both industry and government are paying attention, because you're there with a hot poker, making certain that they're behaving. And so that's what we're going to talk about when we come back, is the fight to protect babies from the toxic heavy metals in baby food. He is Pedram Asfandiary with Wisner Baum, and we will be right back. Stay tuned.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org, the food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org, farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream, and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is The Food Chain. We have so much to talk about and so little time to talk about it in, but we can do that with attorney Pedro Esfandieri, who is with Wisnerbaum LLP, and he is suing. Who are you suing, Pedro?
It's a group of baby food manufacturers, companies, some of the largest in the United States. That some of the names involved in this case are Walmart. Everyone's familiar with Walmart. We have a brand called Nurture, which is owned by Happy Family. There's a brand called Earth's Best, owned by a company named Hain. Sprout Organics, Plum Organics. I think all the names are escaping me, but it's seven main manufacturers of baby food that we're suing on behalf of our clients.
Wow. A lot of them being organic, and we had that conversation in the last segment. It is a multi-district litigation. What does that mean?
That simply means that a whole bunch of cases have been filed all around the country. And because they all involve common issues, they've all been centralized in front of one judge in San Francisco in federal court, who's going to resolve the issues that are common across all of the cases so that we don't get piecemeal rulings from different judges all over the country on the same issues.
Is this like a class action lawsuit?
It's similar, but it's not technically a class action. This is what's called a mass action. It's a whole bunch of individual cases brought by individual families on behalf of their children. And each case is its own unique case. Whereas in a class action, it's typically one or two people who file a case and they represent the interests of a whole class of people who have not filed their cases. Okay. Whereas in this situation, everyone has filed their own case.
Now, are your clients people who have actually suffered harm?
Yes.
So this is 8,000?
Yeah. So we represent 8,000 children, all of whom have been diagnosed with the conditions autism spectrum disorder or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder or ADHD, following their exposure to significant levels of toxins in the baby food that they consume day in, day out during the most vulnerable period of their development.
Wow, 8,000. And that's just your law firm.
That's right.
I assume there are many law firms involved.
There are. There's about five or six other law firms, all representing various groups of families and children.
Then you must, in this, in the course of your pursuing this litigation, you must present actual cases like these people, these children are suffering from this, these children are suffering from that.
That's right. We have to present pretty significant scientific evidence to the court. And actually, the court has a pretty active role before we ever get to a jury trial of ensuring that the scientific evidence is there on the relationship between heavy metal exposure and these conditions that we're pursuing, the injuries that our clients have suffered. And after that, we anticipate going to trial and presenting a case to the jury. But we have a whole host of experts from various different disciplines, like epidemiology, which is a study of how disease occurs in humans. We have toxicologists who are experts on the toxic effects of lead and arsenic. We have food scientists who talk about how these heavy metals end up in the food to begin with. So a whole group of experts who are going to educate the court and the jury on why our clients' claims should prevail.
How do the companies defend themselves?
Well, they've hired very sophisticated big shot lawyers and they've thrown a lot of money at these cases to defend themselves. And they've also hired their own experts.
Right, right.
Who, it's funny, they've taken the position in this case that these toxins, lead and arsenic may well be harmful. However, conditions like autism and ADHD are all genetic. So there's no way our baby food or the toxins in our baby food could have harmed your clients because autism and ADHD is caused by genes. And we don't have evidence or enough scientific evidence that environmental toxins cause these conditions. And our experts disagree. And it really is a battle of the experts
Right.
and a battle of the science in court.
And a judge, a single judge, has to make the determination, correct?
Well, the judge only makes certain determinations. So the judge is responsible for ensuring that the scientific evidence that will eventually be presented to a jury is sound,
Okay.
and that we don't have crackpots going into court and talking about things that don't have scientific merit and validity. But the judge doesn't decide who ultimately prevails, right? That's for the jury to decide. So we're going to try this case in front of a group of 12
Okay.
people one day and present all the facts and the science, and they're going to decide whether these companies should be held liable and whether our clients should be compensated.
Wow. Okay. So the judge's responsibility is to make certain that the information going into the decision-making process is good stuff.
That's right.
Okay. That's a pretty straightforward job then. A good job
Well,
to have.
it's very complicated because oftentimes judges are not scientists. They
Right.
don't have a scientific background. They're lay people like you and me. Of course, they're lawyers. But a lot of them don't have that scientific knowledge. So it's really up to us as the lawyers who've hired these experts to educate the court on what the science shows. And all the court is supposed to do is decide whether the studies that a scientist relies on is good enough, right?
Okay.
That is something that scientists in that field typically rely upon, that is not hocus pocus, astrology, that is something real and scientific using the scientific method. And that's all the judge is supposed to do. The judge is not supposed to resolve scientific disputes and decide for themselves whether autism is all genetic or partly environmental. That job is for the jury. All the judge does is decide, as you just said, the information that the jury is eventually going to hear, the scientific information, is it good science?
As the attorney litigating for the parents, who do you want on the jury?
Well, that answer changes pretty much with every case because each case presents its own unique facts and circumstances that, depending on who you are as a person, you will feel differently about. And that will then impact how I think of who would be a good jury member. I think all lawyers want juries who are open-minded, unbiased, and are going to pay close attention to the evidence in a very complicated scientific case. I like to think about this case kind of two ways. It's both easy and complicated because what we're ultimately talking about, Michael, is poisoning babies, right?
Okay.
That's what these companies have done. They've poisoned babies, and it
Knowingly.
knowingly poisoned babies because they wanted to make a profit. So that's really what the case boils down to. Now, all the science and the complexities of how the heavy metals get in the food and how heavy metals damage the brain, we're going to present that. And we just need an open-minded and attentive jurors to listen to that evidence and then come to a decision. But this case is very simple. It's very wealthy companies who have been doing this for decades, poisoning babies who had no choice in the matter because they wanted to make the bottom line and satisfy their shareholders and line their pockets, which is unfortunately a theme we've seen throughout American history. We saw it with tobacco. We've seen it with pharmaceuticals. We've seen it with the food now. We've seen it with various products on the market. So this is an old theme, and all we need is attentive, open-minded, and fair jurors.
I think I'd start with parents. Young mothers, especially, I think that's where I'd start. Yeah, you can bring your kid into the courtroom. It's fine. Just So difficult to wade through all of the technical details, but that's, I guess, where the truth will eventually come out, is in the technical details as to how much impact heavy metals do have on the developing brain of a baby, how much heavy metals are allowed to be in the baby foods, and how much heavy metals are just going to be in part of our environment. One of the figures that really caught my attention in the studies that I've seen by, what's the group name? Happy Babies, something like that.
Healthy Babies, Bright Futures.
Yes. Is that, in essence, heavy metals are in the baby foods, but they're also in the foods that parents prepare for the babies from raw ingredients.
That's right. So,
and it's pretty equal when it gets right down to it. For example, lead, 90% of baby food, commercial baby food, has lead in it. 80% of the family foods we feed our babies have lead in it. So, and it's pretty equal like that all the way through the heavy metal food chain there. So it's almost like it doesn't matter. We're going to be feeding the babies heavy metals.
Well, that's actually not quite the right way to think about this.
Good.
because here's the difference. When you buy a carrot on the grocery shelf, just a single carrot, no label, no nothing, it's just a regular old carrot, go down to Whole Foods and buy it, it's right there. That's very different. And then you're going to use that carrot to then, you know, mash it up and make baby food with it at home. That's very different from buying a prepackaged product sold by a manufacturer where the label makes claims like, this food is optimal for growth and development of your baby. You need to be feeding your baby this food because it's good for their brain. It's good for their development. It's going to help them with their motor functions and brain growth. They're two very different things. When you're a manufacturer who puts out baby food products, making those kind of bold claims, and you claim to be the best thing since sliced bread, you have a duty, a responsibility to ensure that you're not just a regular carrot on the shelf, because otherwise, what's the difference? Why are we paying a premium on prepackaged baby food? Why are we relying on manufacturers for our food supply to meet our baby's nutritional needs? If you're going to make the claims that these manufacturers of baby food make, you have a duty to ensure that your food contains the lowest levels of toxins that harm a baby's brain. I mean, it's common sense. The carrot sitting there on the grocery shelf is not making any claims. You don't know what the source of that carrot is. It's not marketed for babies. It's not saying on the package, feed this to your baby. This is what they need to grow and develop. The baby food manufacturers are making those claims on their packaging. It's, and with that comes a responsibility.
It's very similar to the Shea laws for pharmaceuticals, for drugs, correct?
Exactly. Right. So when we talk about pharmaceuticals and drugs, I mean, the conversation is a little bit different, but here's where it's similar. Ultimately, the manufacturer of these products are capitalizing on our needs, right? Our needs as human beings in this post-industrial society we live in to eat food and have access to medication is in the hands of these pretty powerful corporate entities. When you take on that responsibility of providing medication and food to the consumer, to the people of society, that comes with the attendant responsibility of ensuring the safety of those products, right? Particularly when we're talking about baby food, which is a very niche and very sort of...
It's almost like targeted. A drug.
Exactly. It's almost like a drug because it's targeting a very specific population.
And in a drug, if you make a claim, you have to put the evidence on the table that proves that claim. But
that's
not
right.
Quite that way for food.
That's
unless
exactly
you're
right.
Selling it baby food in a little jar that says your baby needs this.
That's right. That's exactly right. There is no and has historically not been any kind of FDA requirement that a manufacturer making a little jar of baby food ensures that it has levels of heavy metals that don't harm the baby's brain. There's been no requirement of that. Whereas when in the pharmaceutical context, there's pretty severe and significant requirements on what you have to prove scientifically to bring a drug to market.
Well, you've got quite a job when it gets right down to it, because as I see it, it's pretty much the legal world that is putting the heat on government and industry to clean up their act with respect to toxic heavy metals in baby foods. Seems to me that you and your fellow attorneys are doing the work that we need to have done.
We're definitely trying, and this is something that, as I said before, we've seen time and again when in American society the government is active slow because of various reasons and
But
industry has run amok, it is lawyers' job to step in to ensure the fire is lit and progress is made.
and that's what you're doing. Attorney Pedram Esfandiary, Westnerbaum, LLP. Where can people find out more information about this particular effort of yours to clean up the baby food?
You can visit our website at www.wisnerbaum.com, and there's a whole host of information about this, all the science and the case history and everything else that someone concerned with this would want to know.
Well, thank you so much, Pedram. Enjoy the conversation.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.